never mind. This is joint work with Alex Cox of York. I should point out that it's not York, Ontario, or even New York, New York, but Old York, for those that play cricket, centre of the cricketing universe. So this is joint work with Alex Cox, and depending on the audience, I can either talk about local martingales and option prices, derivative pricing, or in a slightly different audience, I might talk about, or have a title and an abstract that talks more about bubbles. Since this was the Fields Institute, I guess it had to have local martingales somewhere in the title. So let me try and explain what this sort of question that I'm interested in today. So I'm going to do this in a fairly abstract world, so always going to take zero interest rates and dividends just to keep things nice and simple. Now, the standard no arbitrage pricing theory of Delbarn and Schacabeyer, for example, what it tells you is that although you might start with some dynamics under the real world measure, if you can switch to a pricing measure, a martingale measure Q, under which the price process is, well, very loosely a martingale, then there's no arbitrage. But in fact, what the general no arbitrage theory, at least the standard Delbarn Schacabeyer type theory of no free lunch with vanishing risk, that definition of no arbitrage, it turns out that you have the equivalence between no arbitrage and a price process that's a local martingale. So what I'm really interested in, is most models that one writes down, the price process is not just a local martingale, it's actually a true martingale. And what I'm actually interested in is, since the theory only tells you that you must have a local martingale, what would actually happen if instead of having a true martingale, one had a local martingale? So on an abstract level, that's the question that I'm fundamentally interested in. So let's try and put this another way, in a more financial context. So what's the bubble? Some famous examples of bubbles in finance. Dutch tulip mania, 17th century Amsterdam. Prices of tulips had just been discovered. The Dutch were a great trading nation at the time. They just discovered the turkey, and they found all these tulips, and they started to get more and more excited about the varieties of tulips they could get from crossbreeding, and became fashionable, or for whatever reason, tulips became more and more valuable. To the extent that over a sort of 20, 30 years, the prices of tulips rose by a factor of 100 or a factor of 1,000. And then suddenly people thought, well, this is a tulip. What can I do with this thing? I can plant it in the garden and get a flower. Very nice. But is it really worth what I'm paying for it? And for whatever reason, again, nobody really knows why, suddenly in about a week, the value of tulips, the value is the wrong word here, the price of tulips fell through the floor by a factor of about 20. Okay, so there was a sudden collapse in the price of tulips. Second one on my list, the South Sea bubble. So this is where the first use of the word bubble. South Sea bubble moved from Amsterdam across the channel to England. Again, England was another big trading nation. They just decided they would like to start trading with South America. South Sea is South America. Unfortunately, the Spanish were already there doing most of the trading in South America, so this was slightly dodgy politically at the time. But somebody had the bright idea of selling shares on this non-existent trade with South America. So somebody else then thought, well, that looks, who knows, it's a share, it can't go down, I'll buy this thing. And these things started getting popular, despite the fact there was no real foundation for the value of these things. These things had no value. What's something worth? It's worth what somebody else will pay for it. And as long as these things were fashionable, the price of South shares in this one particular company, although there were other companies around with similar phenomena, just sort of rose. Essentially, though, this is, calling this a bubble, this was a fraud. This is English history. This is a fraud as much as anything else. There was no fundamental value underneath this company, and eventually people realized. And the people in the know, of course, realized first, sold, the people running the company sold all the shares first, took the money, disappeared off. So this is a fraud as much as anything else. And anything else that I'm going to call a bubble, one can think of some cases perhaps it's fraud. 20th century, again, there were loads of examples where the market went up and up, and then suddenly, for whatever reason, sentiment changed, and there was a often sudden crash where prices fell. So one thing you can do is to build some model of growth and crashes, but that doesn't fit into the standard mathematical no arbitrage type theory. And what I want to do is to remain within that theory, but still have this notion that, well, essentially that in some sense things are overpriced, things are overvalued, and that at some future point the market will correct itself to get rid of this overvaluing. So to me, but for the purposes of this talk at least, the definition of a bubble is that the price process is going to go down in future. And since the price process is a non-negative local martingale, which I'm assuming because I want to work in the standard no arbitrage type framework, I'm thinking particularly about the cases where the price process is a strict super martingale and not a true martingale, or a strict local martingale if you like, and not a true martingale. So having talked about some of the examples from history, prehistory, let me try and write down some mathematical models so you can see the sorts of things that must happen in these models to get this feature. So current price times zero is some number S. Suppose that the price process follows this fairly simple but time inhomogeneous SDE. Now this is a nice SDE because I can solve it explicitly, and although my process is driven by Brownian motion, but I can think of it as an exponential of a time change different Brownian motion where this time change is given by this log function. Okay, so what's going to happen is that by time capital T, put U equals T into my definition firstly for A is going to explode, and therefore okay, it's Brownian motion B bar being evaluated at some very big time, but that actually gets killed by this minus infinity now. So what's going to happen to this process? I mean, this isn't hard to justify completely rigorously rather than just wave my hands like this, is that by time capital T, although this process started positive, it's a non-negative local martingale, by time capital T, this process is going to be at zero almost surely. So this is the first example that I want you to think of a non-negative local martingale. We can get some intuition for what should happen by thinking of this example. Slightly extreme, because by time T you know exactly where the S is going to be, but it's still a good example for thinking about the sorts of things that might happen. Okay, so my second example, so this one is used a little bit more in financial modeling. Remember again that I'm taking the interest rate to be zero, or I'm using discounted quantities. So if alpha was 1, we'd just have exponential Brownian motion here. And the CEV model is to take dS as S to some power dB. And people do normally take alpha less than 1, but there's no reason why one couldn't take alpha bigger than 1, at least in principle. In particular, if alpha is 2, then there are some nice... two things. If alpha equals 2, then this example is the classic example of a L2 local martingale that's not a true martingale. That's one way to think about it. On the other hand, if alpha equals 2, the reason why it's a classic example is that if you take the three-dimensional Bessel process and then you take 1 over that thing, then you get exactly this SDE. And the three-dimensional Bessel process is the radial part of three-dimensional Brownian motion, so we can do lots of calculations in alpha is 2. Okay, in particular, you can work out, or you can look up, in my case, the probability density of the price process at time capital T, and you can do things like calculate the expected value at time capital T. And if this thing had been a true martingale, then the expected value at time T would have to be the current value. But in fact, we're not seeing that. What happens when you do the calculations is you see that some mass has been lost. And we're in exactly the case of a strict local martingale. The current price, the expected time T value is the current value minus something. So this thing is going down on average. It's a strict local martingale. Okay, so what's happening in both these examples, and in the next two as well to a certain extent? Local martingale, going to start at some point S, and what you know, property of local martingales is why they are local martingales. If you put some sort of bound up here, so at N, and if I think about my stochastic, my price process, I'm drawing it like some sort of Brownian motion, if I think about it up to the first time it leaves this region, so up to the first time we get to time capital T, or it hits level N, then this thing is a true martingale. Okay? Now, what's happening in these examples is that if the price goes down, so let me draw a path that goes down, well, at least in the second example, you just get something like this, and everything stays nice and normal, nice and typical. Okay? If, on the other hand, the price goes up, well, now if we look at the volatility of this process, or the diffusion coefficient's getting bigger. So I haven't drawn this very well, because when we get up here, it's really moving up and down a lot quicker. Now, because it's moving up and down a lot quicker, some of these paths are going to come down, and they're then going to start behaving more normally. Okay, but the ones that go up, got to run out of board here, the ones that go up are going to move even faster. Okay, and again, some of the paths are going to carry on going right up, but few of them are going to come down to more reasonable levels. And eventually, what really happens is that as you get to time capital T, or as S gets big, it just goes so fast that it can't stay there. So the paths that come down sort of stay down, but the paths that get big start moving so fast that they can't stay big, that they have to come down eventually. And this is really, at least in a very vague, hand-wavy sense, this is why these processes on this slide are actually local martingales rather than true martingales, or why they're strict local martingales and not true martingales. On average, in at least when you bound them, the paths go up as much as they go down. But when you remove this bound, the ones that go up start going faster and faster to the extent that they all come down again eventually. Okay, so you might sort of think that those two examples are perhaps a little artificial. So let me introduce another example that is around quite a bit in the stochastic volatility literature. Now, this example is slightly outside my framework because in a stochastic volatility model, the model is incomplete and you don't have unique replication prices and so on. So I'm just doing this one example as an example of a strict local martingale, and then I'm going to exclusively think about the complete market situation. So as we shall see, this model is a problem if you have non-zero correlation. Now, in defense of Holland White, when they introduced the stochastic volatility model in 87, they took zero correlation. So this isn't a criticism in any way of the sort of the standard thing that the model they introduced, but if one was to try and take their model and generalize it to non-zero correlation, then there are problems, as we should see. So what's this model? Basically, the asset follows exponential Brownian motion, but with a volatility process V as stochastic volatility, and in this model, the volatility itself is an exponential Brownian motion. And the Brownian motion driving the stock and the Brownian motion driving the volatility may or may not be correlated, and I'm taking them to have correlation rho. Okay, and my claim is that if rho is positive, this is a strict local martingale. Okay, well, a very quick proof. Suppose it wasn't a strict local martingale. If it wasn't a strict local martingale, then I can take, Q, I guess, is my pricing measure, the one that I've written the price process down under. I can form that the rate on Nickenham derivative, dp by dq. Now, if S is a true martingale, the P that I construct in this fashion is a genuine change of measure. So under the assumption that I'm starting with a true martingale, I get a genuine change of measure. And I can use this measure, I can think of this measure in terms of a Gazanov-type theorem, and think about what happens under P to the Brownian motion B. Okay, well, it turns out that this new Brownian motion essentially is related to the old one by a difference in drift of size V. And if I go through and I see, well, what is the SDE for the volatility under this new probability measure P, I can write everything down. And then I can look at what I'm left with, and I have an SDE for V. And I can look at that SDE, and I can say, well, okay, V is a non-negative process. It might get big after a while. If it gets big, then it starts having this drift. And moreover, there's a V squared at the end. So if it gets big, the drift gets very big. And then the process is very big, so the drift gets even bigger. And basically what happens to this process is that in finite time, this process will go off and hit plus infinity. Okay, now, fine, so this process explodes under P. On the other hand, under Q, it's just exponential Brownian motion. It doesn't explode under Q. So if it's exploding under P and not exploding under Q, that means that P and Q aren't equivalent. So I didn't have a true martingale here in the first place. Hence, it's not a true martingale. Okay, if that was too technical, I fully understand. Here's another example I want you to think about, which is related, and the way you prove you have a true, you don't have a true martingale is basically exactly the same as the last example, which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the last example. So here's one fundamental reason, economic reason, why you might think that how you might want to model a bubble. Okay, so the idea is you have some price process for tulips or whatever, and it's going along nice and smoothly, and then the price goes up, say. Okay, and you have all these people who are sat around trading all sorts of things, and suddenly they start to notice that the price of tulips has gone up. And suddenly everybody focuses in on tulips. Perhaps tulips is a bad example. Google shares. Google shares go up. Everybody suddenly thinks, oh, Google shares. They're on the front page of the newspaper today. Maybe I should have a look at Google shares. And so people that would have ignored Google shares suddenly get interested in Google shares. And interest essentially leads to volatility in the price. And so the price moves more because there's more interest. And then this just becomes a self-reinforcing mechanism. The price moves more, there's more volatility, more people start looking what's happening, and you just get this feedback effect on the volatility. Okay, so that's what this model here is trying to capture. You have a standard exponential Brownian motion model for the asset price, except that the volatility process is stochastic. Now, in the last model that I had, it was just a standard stochastic volatility type model, and the volatility was driven by its own autonomous SDE. In this case, what I'm going to say is the volatility is some function of the sigma process, and essentially the sigma process measures the distance between the current price and some past average of the prices. Okay, and I'm using some sort of log scale here, and the lambda eta minus lambda r is something that says, well, I take some sort of exponential weighting of past price to give me a sort of current price and a past average price. And if that difference between the current price and recent history or historic price is big, then something's happening to the share, and I'm going to watch this share. If I'm watching the share and trading in the share, then that's going to push up volatility. So this model here is exactly trying to describe this feedback effect in prices move, people are interested, people watch what's happening, they start trading more in that share, that causes prices to move further, and then this whole thing just escalates. So, I first started thinking about this model more years ago than I care to remember, and then we have this big problem that we wanted the price process that we were constructing to be a true martingale, because that's what you do. I mean, you want things to be nice, you want them to be true martingales. So we started imposing all these regularity conditions to make it a true martingale. And now, many years later, I'm going back to this example and thinking, perhaps that's the wrong point. This is a perfectly natural specification of this feedback volatility effect. So perfectly reasonable specifications, you get this strict local martingale. Now, what would happen in that case? And that's what I want to talk about in whatever time I have left. Okay, so I want to go back to the sort of the abstract mathematical theory. So I want to think about complete market models driven perhaps by just a single Brownian motion. And I want to think about trading strategies in such a model. Now, trading strategies should all be self-financing processes. That's one of the natural assumptions you want to put on a trading strategy. If that's the only assumption that you make, then you allow yourself to have doubling strategies. And if there are doubling strategies, there are ways of making money for nothing, and that there are arbitrages. Okay, so you want to somehow rule out doubling strategies. One way to rule out doubling strategies is to insist that any trading wealth process that you're going to count as admissible, anything the market counts as feasible, is going to have to be non-negative. Okay, so let's use that definition. So a trading strategy is admissible if it's self-financing and if the price process associate, sorry, if the wealth process is non-negative. So given that notion of an admissible strategy, and this is all very classical, you can start to ask, what is the price of a European type option, or what is the price of an American type option? And in a sort of classical setting, one can take as a definition that the price of an option is the cheapest initial fortune with which you can finance an admissible super-replicating wealth process. So admissible, I've said, well, that means that the wealth strategy has to be self-financing, and it also has to be non-negative. And by super-replicating, if there's some claim that I'm trying to price, my wealth process has to dominate that claim at time capital T, say. Okay, so it has to super-replicate. And under this definition, again, this is all completely classical, you can prove that there's a formula for the price of the European option, which is just to take expectations under the Martingale measure. Okay? And there's a formula for the American option, which is as given here. You take expectations under the Martingale measure, and then you take a supremum over stopping times between now and time capital T. Okay? So these are three lines to prove my theorem from my definition. The key thing here really is the mathematical definition of what you mean by a fair price. Now, this can be applied to any claim H. In order to establish notation as much as anything else, let me write C for call, P for put, and I'll put a superscript for A for American and E for European, T for current time. So let me remind you of some facts that everybody knows about option prices. There's a put call parity result. The price of a put is directly related to the price of a call and given by the formula as on the slide. So if you know the price of a call, you can calculate the price of a put without doing any calculations, or at least just by doing a little bit of addition and subtraction. You don't have to go back and reprice using your PDE or whatever, just given by an immediate formula. So, I'm told that some exchanges only quote prices of calls, because if you wanted to know what the put price was, you just use put-call parity and there you have it. Okay, so everybody knows put-call parity is true. Think about options with convex payoffs. For an option with a convex payoff, remember I'm taking R equals naught, it's never optimal to exercise early. You would always wait until the last moment to exercise. So an American option, you would never exercise early. You only take the value at time capital T. So essentially the American and European options are the same. The price of an American option is the same as the price of a put. Very similar. Think about calls, time strike K. But think about varying the maturity time, capital T, of these options. Okay? General rule is that if the option is available, if the time of maturity of the option is larger, then the price of the option is bigger. And the last one, it's sort of related, and it's not quite as fundamental as the others. There are various theorems that say that under suitable hypotheses, and most of the rest is sort of very, very general. So if you have a diffusion model, a nice diffusion model for the underlying, then there are theorems that tell you that the price of the option, thought of as a function of the value of the underlying, is convex. Okay, so I want to draw one little picture here. There's K. That's the intrinsic value. Price looks something like that. It's a convex function of S. Okay, so these are all well-known, completely standard properties. So here's my main abstract result. Suppose we have a bubble. Okay, then by my definition of what a bubble is, that means that S is a strict super Martingale and not a true Martingale, or a strict local Martingale and not a true Martingale. And that means that the expected value of ST is less than S naught. So the first three are almost equivalent by definition. So now we start on the results with a little more content. If S has a bubble, then put call parity fails. Put call parity is no longer true if you have a bubble. If there's a bubble, and you look at this function relating the put price to the initial price S naught, then that, as you take the limit as k goes to infinity, so I should draw this one as well. Okay, let me try and do this the right way around. Think about put prices, so for fixed S naught and varying k. If you do that, then essentially what you get typically is a function of this shape. Okay, now the point is that in the last picture I drew, I asked you to fix k and to vary s. But of course that's not really what happens in the real world. There is only one S. You can't really think of varying S, the underlying. What you can do is think about options with various different strikes trading at a given moment. And so that's why I am talking about puts here, but the price of a put, so that's the vertical axis. In the Black-Scholes model, if you plot the price of a put for fixed S, fixed maturity time capital T, and think of it as a function of K, you get some increasing concave function exactly like that. And moreover, if you look at the difference between the price and this line, I mean, this line is just S minus K. If I continue it down here. Sorry, K minus S. Okay, then as K gets big, the difference between my curve and my straight line goes to zero. Okay? That's false in one of my bubble models. Okay? I said that obvious and easy to prove that the price of a European option is the same as the price of an American option for a convex payoff. That is false for a bubble model. Okay? For exactly that, well, given that that's false, it's not hard to show this next one. Think about American options, American calls, and again, let the strike price go off to something very big, then the limit as k goes off to infinity is not zero as you'd expect. You can take an American call with arbitrarily large strike, and the price does not get arbitrarily small. So this last one is much more related to what's going on in these cases. If there's a bubble, and it's much more related to this picture I've drawn here, if there's a bubble, and you ask yourself, well, let's look at the probability under the Martingale measure Q, look at the probability that this the maximum of the price gets above some big level k, little k, bad choice of letter, little k. Okay, and then you let k tend off to plus infinity, then k times this probability does not tend to naught. So, in fact, what happens is that this q probability that the max sup of su is bigger than n is of the order of 1 over n, or of the order of s naught over n. In the sense that the very first model that I wrote down, this time homogeneous one, it's not just the twiddles here, it's actually equality there. And for the others, it's not too hard to show this. So in all these cases, the sort of fundamental key to proving this result is a comparison between the price of the American option and the price of the European option, and you find that there's a difference between these two that doesn't actually depend on K. So, sketch of proof, if you like. Here the top line is a true identity. I've told you that one has to be careful about these things, but there's nothing one has to be careful about in writing the top line down. Okay, so normally the root to put call parity is one writes out the top line, and then one takes expectation. And when one takes expectation, the first term is just the European call price strike K, the second term is the European put price, and because I expect the value of ST is S0, on the right-hand side we just get S0 minus K. However, in this case we're in a bubble, and so the expected value of ST is not S0. And so, in a bubble case, you don't get put-to-call parity. So, if there was no bubble, well, I wouldn't get this bit at the end, and I would have put-to-call parity. However, because there's a bubble, expected value of ST and S0 are different, and so I don't get put-to-call parity. Okay? Once you've got that, most of the others are just some sort of definition changing. The European price, for instance, has to be positive. So if you play around with that equation, you can get some expression for PE and the European put price and take limits as K goes to infinity, and I'm lucky here. This is what you want to play around with. So this is just algebra to get here. Now take limits as K goes to infinity. Well, this is tending to, well, certainly not negative. It does, in fact, tend to naught. But the term I'm left with is strictly positive. So even as you let K tend to infinity, you don't get the limit zero back that you would expect from the picture that I've lost from under here. I think I'll skip a proof of this result. It turns out that in order to prove it, the best way to do it is to prove some sort of comparison between the European and the American proofs. And if I have 5 minutes at the end, I might come back to this. But let's skip any sort of formal proof of that last bit and just start by doing a couple of examples to see what happens. Oh, I fully agree with this. This is why I was very explicit about what I meant by price. I say that fair price is the smallest initial fortune with which one can super replicate the option payoff. Okay, now if you don't like my conclusions, then you have to go back and you have to find one of my hypotheses that you don't like, and you have to say how you're going to change it. Now, one thing you can do is you say, well, these strict local Martingale models are just dumb. I want nothing to do with them. If you say that, then fine. You don't have any of these problems. Okay? If you do want to, the mathematical arbitrage, no arbitrage theory, does not exclude strict local Martingales. Okay? So if you say, well, I want to work in the general mathematical no arbitrage theory, I do want to think about these strict local Martingales, then you can come up with a different definition of what you mean by price. Okay? And that may or may not solve some of these paradoxes. Okay? But what I'm saying is that if one does the standard classical things that that one is taught sometimes about what the fair price is, it's the cheapest super-replicating strategy, and therefore one is led into these contradictions is the wrong word, rather surprising conclusions that hopefully make one step back to think about what's actually happening in these cases. But I agree, if you're prepared to change your definitions, you go with you may recover put-to-call parity, for instance. And I may even, depending on how things go, I may tell you a different set of definitions that would indeed restore put-to-call parity. So think about the very first example that I gave you, in which case ST ends up at naught. Okay? So the value, the price, by my definition, the price of a call with strike zero is the expected value of, well, with any strike, in fact, is the expected payoff. Okay? Now, ST ends up at naught, so the expected value, ST minus K, therefore, positive part, is also naught. The expected value of the zero random variable is naught. So the European price of a call option with any strike K has to be zero in this model. Okay? Because it just never pays off. ST ends up at naught. This thing never pays off. If something has payoff zero, its price must be zero. I can certainly replicate it for nothing. And so zero is an upper bound on the price of the option in this model. Okay, what about the American option? Okay, well, let's to be very simple, let's think of K equals naught. K equals naught. So the American option with zero strike. Now I can exercise immediately. Okay, in which case I get S. So the American option has to be worth at least S. On the other hand, holding S is a super replicating strategy. So S is actually the cheapest super-replicating strategy. So it's very easy to see in this model that the price of the European and the American options are different. Okay, well, what happens in the CEV model with parameter 2? Again, the nice thing about this model is one can actually do all the calculations you need. So I did this before, one can work out the expected value of ST, and it turns out to be less than S, so we are indeed in the bubble case. One can look at the prices of calls, and you can draw a picture of them. So this is a representation of the picture, and one of the features that I told you was that for nice diffusion models, the call price should be convex in the underlying. So let's draw what happens in this model and draw the price, the European call option price, as a function of the initial value of the strike. Then in fact what one finds is that in this model, the price is bounded above. And if it's bounded above, and it's increasing to start with, it certainly ain't convex. Okay, there's some sort of asymptote at this height. In particular, it's not convex. It's not concave either, but it's not convex. Okay, so let me leave the proof out to a certain extent. I think I gave you four completely standard, completely obvious properties of option prices. And I can't remember how many of them I've debunked in this case. But here's one of them that I haven't talked about yet. Time value of calls. Okay, so again, I'm thinking about fixed value of S, fixed current asset price S. And I'm thinking about these prices as a function of K. So you imagine options with more than one strike trading at a current time now. And you can draw a picture. I drew one for puts. You can draw a picture of what the asset price, what the call prices must look like. Okay. And this is the standard picture. In the standard null bubble case, the call with strike zero that is indistinguishable from holding the asset. Okay. And so the call with strike zero is essentially the price of that thing should be just the price of the asset. Okay, so I've called this CE of K, but key point is that that's just equal to S. Okay, so if you have an option with maturity zero, as a function of K, what does the option price look like? Answer is this sort of inverted hockey stick function. It's a diagonal down, line down, and then horizontally constant. Okay? If you allow for a little bit of time, so if you take some positive t and you ask what are call prices like, well again, it's still true that they must come to this point up here, top left, and then call prices must be a decreasing convex function of the strike. If not, there are arbitrages, and you can generate those arbitrages by butterfly spreads Now let's go to a later time. Again, the call price function, thought of as a function of K, again, it has to be a decreasing convex function again, otherwise butterfly spreads will give you an arbitrage. But also calendar spreads essentially tell you that the red line, the call prices for later time T prime, must everywhere be uniformly above the blue line. Okay, and if you like, this is just Jensen's inequality. Condition on things happening at time t, you have to get things this way around. At least that gives you one way, and then there's some theory of Markov processes, or to show that given those call prices, I can find a model with those properties. So that's the classic case of what happens, and as time goes up, we switch from the black line, t equals zero, to the blue line, and then option prices just rise with maturity. What happens in the strict local martingale case? Well, just by looking at this left-hand end, we can see that prices are not going to be uniformly, strictly increasing in maturity. Okay, with maturity zero, the call price with zero strike, that's just the expected value of ST, that's just S naught when T equals naught. On the other hand, as T gets bigger, essentially the expected value of ST, it's a strict local martingale. As T gets bigger, this left-hand end of these functions is just going to move down. uniformly over time. So this classic, completely standard property of price processors just is no longer true in the strict local martingale case. Okay, so Tom asked, what happens if he changes his definition of what you mean by price? Okay, can you get all these properties back? Can you recover all these things that I'm worrying about? I'm not going to change the definition of price. I'm going to change the definition of what counts as an admissible strategy. Okay, I said that an admissible strategy had to be self-financing, and it had to stay non-negative. And of course, if we're doing derivative pricing, we want to super-replicate the option payoff as well. And then when you price, you find the cheapest super-replicating strategy. So rather than think about an option with payoff H and then just forget about it, I'm going to think about an option with payoff H and some collateral requirement G. Okay, so up to now, I've basically been taking G equals naught. And the idea is that I've sold this option on an exchange, or I've sold this option somehow on an exchange, and so I've guaranteed to make this payoff H. Now, the collateral requirement is, because I'm short this option, the exchange, I mean, suppose the underlying goes up and the value of the underlying gets very big, and the exchange turns around and says to me, look, you could be out for a lot of money here. We want to see some front from you. We want you to post some collateral. Okay, so that's the role of what G is. Okay, so I introduce this collateral requirement that says that if the intrinsic value of your option gets very big, then it's not sufficient for you to be following some self-financing strategy that's non-negative. You must be following some self-financing strategy that is also quite big. And what happens is that if the claim is at some value S, then you must be posting with the exchange some value G of S. Okay, so this reduces the set of admissible strategies, and therefore it may make the price of an option a little bit bigger, even a European option a little bit bigger, because I've changed my definition of admissibility. So if one takes G equals naught, you just get back exactly the definition of a European option that I have been working with. Cheapest super-replicating strategy using my old definition of admissibility, where you just had to keep replicating strategies non-negative. If you take G to be H, then essentially you have an American-style option. You have a super-replicating strategy, and at each intermediate time, this super-replicating strategy has to have enough money to pay off the claim if it was to be exercised at that instant. Okay, so that for whatever time the purchaser of the option chooses to exercise, you have enough money to pay them off. So you're covering the supremum of the stopping times of the expected payoff of the option. So G equals naught is exactly the European case. G equals H is exactly the American case. And now, again, I don't think I'm going to have time or the inclination to prove this. If one takes some value of alpha between 0 and 1, then one can show that the price of an option, so a call option, so a standard call option, given a collateral requirement that you post some proportion, alpha, of the intrinsic value, then using my definitions of admissible strategies, this is just exactly alpha times the American price plus 1 minus alpha times the European price of the call. So these C's are using my old definitions of admissible strategies, and this V over here is using my new definition. So in particular, if I take alpha equals 1, if I require you to post collateral requirements that are just the intrinsic value of the option, then on the right-hand side, I get the American price. On the left-hand side, I get 0. Okay, and if... So here's one way that one can recover put-call parity and all the other properties that we talked about, I think. Certainly put-call parity. What you do is you change the definition of what is an admissible strategy, and you change it from one that requires you to keep your wealth non-negative to one that requires you to cover the intrinsic value of the option. Okay, so under this definition, one Clearly he gets back that European and American options have the same price, because essentially I've converted the thing into an American option. I must be covering the intrinsic value. One gets back put call parity, one gets back increasing in this, that the prices are increasing in the time. Okay, so in these, so this is my closing message, if you like. If one wants to allow for these strict local martingales, then if one takes standard definitions, which is a perfectly reasonable and natural thing to do, then lots of the just sort of basic, obvious properties of option prices are no longer true. Okay? So if there are bubbles out there in the market, and you may or may not agree with my definition of bubble, but Alan Greenspan thinks that there's a bubble in the market. So if my definition is approximating what he thinks is happening, then there are bubbles in the market. And therefore, put-call parity need not hold in the market. Therefore, options need not be increasing in time in the market. Now, if you find that put-call parity does hold, then maybe that means that the definitions that I'm using to come up with my counterintuitive results are wrong, and perhaps it's because of this sort of factor. Andrew Davison told me in Banff that if you were trading internet-type stocks, even if you had a European option on it, somewhere, because it was an internet stock and the chance of it being taken over between now and maturity were actually quite big, then, I mean, it was a serious question, what happens if the company gets taken over? Okay, and so one needs to decide. You have an option on a company that may not exist by time capital T. So one has to write into the contract somehow what happens. And he told me that what happens, or what used to happen, is that they wrote in some into the definition of the contract that if the company was taken over at some intermediate time, then you've got the intrinsic value. So essentially, even though this was written as a European option, it had this sort of American type, if you're going to super replicate the thing, it may be that you're busily away super replicating. Through nobody's fault or out of anybody's control, the company suddenly gets taken over and the option pays out at that instant. Not at time capital T, when you thought it was going to be at some instant in between. If you're going to super replicate that thing, then essentially, okay, you're not posting collateral with an exchange, you're posting collateral with yourself, if you like. You have to keep at least G. In that case, even with an internet-type stock, one gets that European and American options are the same, and put-call parity holds, and everything's nice. Okay, so final one-sentence summary. If there are bubbles, there may be problems, but there also may be ways out of them if you're prepared to use different definitions where appropriate.